So I literally just got back from seeing the new Lilo and Stitch movie with the girls.
How was it?
A roller coaster, if we're being honest.
Of emotions?
Of emotions, yeah. Both. The movie should win Comedy of the Year. Movie of the Year, definitely. I've never been more hooked on a children's movie than I was a couple hours ago. Like, and I cried. I don't know. It's a Disney movie, too, which I hate Disney movies. I think it's because I've been through life experiences. So like every time something happened in the movie, like a little memory came back, like and a tear.
Of all the times you adopted a little blue alien?
I don't even know. I don't remember what was going on in the movie, but he, at some point he just started talking. He's like, family. And I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
I've started crying at movies in the past 5 years, and I never had before, so I don't know what's going on.
You're going to start crying at commercials soon.
I might, but going into this case today, it's a pretty emotional case for me at least, so God knows what you're going to get.
Oh boy.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode number 56 of the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, the one and only Melissa Spivey.
We already decided there can only be one because it would just be way too much to have more than that.
It's true. And with all the genetic genealogy talk of late and cloning.
I'm going to clone myself.
No, you're not.
Give the world a gift.
We are on the home stretch of our June block, which we're calling Hot Summer Cold Cases. And man, we have covered some pretty intense stories the past 2 weeks, or you have, I should say.
Yeah, week one was a roller coaster. Week two was just really fascinating. Like, I really like that we're learning about the genetic genealogy and still obsessed with Colleen. So this is like week three, guys.
I get it. And I agree. I love talking about it because it's such a revolutionary science and it's so cool. Like that Nancy Anderson story, I don't know why I felt so attached to that story. I loved every moment of that. And I think it was because I felt like a little connection to Nancy. Like I just felt like I really understood her from how she was described, you know?
Well, I have another one that hinges on genetic genealogy and Colleen again.
Man,
for next month.
Making all kinds of appearances.
Love her.
Well, we're not going to waste any time getting into today's case because it is a long one. And I am not going to apologize for that because I promise you it is worth it. And here's the deal. This is a case that I've wanted to cover since Murder Unscripted was just a fleeting thought. I was like, if we start a podcast, I definitely want to make sure that this is in the lineup. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because it's one that I was lucky enough to field produce for Cold Case Files in 2022. And again, it was the core episodes, not the spinoffs. So this story is crazy because from the moment I read the pitch and definitely after I started reaching out to the family and the detectives, this case made me feel literally all the feels. I mean, anger, sadness, compassion, absolute outrage. And you're going to see why as we get into this story. But it also came at a time when I was going through some stuff personally. You know, it was like, so there was like a moment in the case that really hit close to home, especially because it starts out in Pennsylvania, which we'll see in a minute. But it was just the perfect case given to me at the perfect time. So before we get into this, I do want to issue kind of a few caveats. And this one is more of a shout out to Sharon McPhillips. And Sharon is Tara's mom, and Tara is our victim today. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Sharon and her then husband, Tara's stepdad, Keith, for the show, for the Cold Case Files episode. And they are truly wonderful, incredible people. I can't find enough adjectives to describe these people. They made me feel so connected to Tara that I literally felt like I knew her. As soon as I was just on the phone and I'm listening to stories about Tara, and it's like, man, you just, some cases hit different than others. And this is one of those cases.
Yeah.
And Sharon and I are still friends, and she's a huge supporter of Murder Unscripted and what we're doing. So I just wanted to take a second to recognize her and thank her for once again entrusting me to tell Tara's story, because I did reach out to her and just get her blessing.
Thank you, Sharon.
Seriously. So the second caveat is that I'm going to tread kind of lightly around some of the people of interest in this case. One, because they're dangerous people. I don't know them, but I've read all about them, believe me. And also based on something that happened to my crew, not on set, but as part of the production of this case that I will never, ever forget. And I'll tell you all about that at the end.
Yikes.
Yeah. Buckle up, man.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm excited to sit back and listen today.
Good. Yeah. It's unusual for me to come out with a long story to tell you, but here we go. So I want to take you back to Scranton, Pennsylvania in 2001. And for those of us who are not from PA, Scranton is probably best known as being the home of everyone's favorite paper company, Dunder Mifflin, in a fictional television show called The Office. And yes, Melissa, it is fictional. I hate to break it to
you. It is not. No, they're my friends.
And while I guarantee you there's people named Dwight and Toby and Michael in Scranton, it's also known to us locals as an area that is in the coal region, quote unquote. And that's because of its history producing anthracite.
Remember Michael wanted to go to the bottom of the coal mine in the industrial elevator.
Exactly.
Didn't understand why there was no laser tag.
No! God, please, no! No!
Well, in early 2001, Scranton was also home to Tara Danielle Sidorovich and her wonderful family. Born on October 30th, 1981, Tara was the daughter of Sharon and Ronald Ord. That's why sometimes online you'll see her identified as Tara Ord, or sometimes it's even hyphenated Tara Ord Sidorovich, but Sidorovich is what was on her driver's license. She had two younger siblings, Veronica and Paul, and from the moment she was born, she had a very special relationship with Sharon, and that was evident from the very first conversation I had with her, and you could tell because Sharon always referred to Tara as my Tara when she was talking about her. And I guarantee she still calls her that to this day. And what I learned about Tara was that she was kind, she was caring, just full of life. And the second she walked into a room, the vibe just got happier. She had a way of just really connecting people with her bubbly personality and just her overall genuine nature.
Some people I feel like are just like that. And they're always the person like you want to come to one of your gatherings because you know, like, they'll be able to entertain themselves and like the rest of the guests.
Exactly. And that's who Tara was. But make no mistake. So she was also described as tough by a family friend. And this friend had told the story of one time when she watched three boys literally ganging up on Tara, trying to throw her in a pool. And she basically threw them off like rag dolls. And I don't know if they ended up going to the pool or if they just,
good
you
for
know,
her.
Exactly. But point being, she could hold her own. So as a student, Tara was absolutely top-notch and incredibly popular among her peers. So she made the list for the who's who among American high school students twice. And she was a catcher on the softball team. She was a cheerleader. And in what little free time she had left, she really enjoyed doing art. She was just a really good kid with a really bright future. Like, no, not a bad word to be said about her.
She's very much reminding me of Sarah Yarborough from a couple weeks ago.
Absolutely. How old was Sarah? Sarah was younger though, right? 16?
She was 16. Yeah. But just like the personality and like very bright, very active in school, very bubbly, very genuine. Like I said, a megawatt smile.
Absolutely. And not involved in anything unsavory. Like she didn't hang out, run around with gangs. She did great. And she had her whole world ahead of her. So I can't speak to the family dynamic at the time in Scranton because my knowledge of the case picks up years later, but it's not overly important. I'm referring to Sharon and Ronald Ord. I don't know. They split up at some point. But what does happen is that Sharon lands in the arms of a man named Keith McPhillips. And this family dynamic I do know personally, and it is absolutely unbreakable. So Keith is a hardworking motorcycle riding, we'll call him a bad boy, but he's not really, he's a big teddy bear. If you Keith, but you are, man. So Keith steps into this situation and immediately becomes an incredible role model to Sharon's kids, Veronica and Paul. Like, he's just a really good person. And this family prided themselves on togetherness. So if one kid had a violin recital, every member of the family was there. If Tara had a cheer competition, they were sitting right in the front row. Like, it was just, everything was together.
That's sweet. And major, like, credit to him for taking on that responsibility of, like, three stepkids.
So as far as Tara and her mom goes, they really enjoyed going to the movies. They would, like, go shopping, chit-chat over coffee. They also loved to dance. And there's this super fun picture I saw one time of them just cutting a rug somewhere. I don't know. It might have been a wedding or some kind of birthday party. I don't know, because they were dressed up. So it was just, it really described the perfect mother-daughter relationship. And the same could actually be said about Tara and Keith. I remember Keith telling me that Tara would make these ridiculous, like, triple-decker PB&J sandwiches, and they would just sit at the kitchen table and eat them and just chat about life. And Keith would sometimes make Tara polish his motorcycle, like, with him, but it wasn't about the motorcycle. It was about just them hanging out and bonding together over something.
Right. That's tough, especially when your parent starts or is married to someone who's not like your other parent.
Right.
So it's great that they were able to click like that and have a good relationship.
Absolutely. If you just looked at them on that surface level, you would never know that that wasn't a biological father and daughter. So let's jump ahead to 2001. The now 19-year-old Tara had recently graduated from high school, and the family was kind of toying with the idea of moving somewhere sunny for what they describe as a chance at a better life. And Tara wasn't exactly thrilled, though. Like, picture being a young 19-year-old recent graduate. It's a humongous change. And she was kind of confident that, like, you know what? I'm an adult now. I'll start my own life in Scranton. So the family was like, you know what? Go for it. I bet you $20 that you'll be down there with us before you know it. So Tara says, fine, bet. Put their money where their mouth is. And in September of 2001, Sharon, Keith, Veronica, and Paul pack up their things and they rent a tiny coral-colored bungalow at 4729 Westwood Drive in the tea and green section of Punta Gorda, Florida, which is this quaint little town on the kind of the western coast of Florida. I would say roughly halfway between like Sarasota and Naples.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, it was a beautiful area, quiet. And so 3 weeks later, Tara pulls up in her car with all her stuff. And that was just how important family was to her. So she made it 3 weeks before moving.
Oh, well, you know, 3 weeks, that's good. She tried it out.
Tried
her best. Wasn't feeling it. Get it?
Well, and the reason this family picked Punta Gorda was because it was very affordable and they had an awesome school system. And that meant it wouldn't only be good for the younger two kids, Paul and Veronica, but apparently once you, like, are there for a year, you get free college tuition, which is freaking awesome. I know, right?
Yeah.
So that was obviously setting Tara up for success when she kind of decided, like, what she wanted to do with her life and would be a free education for her. So great situation. Needless to say, the family was now trying to figure out what island life was going to look like, their new start. Keith and Sharon both got new jobs, and Tara was kind of deciding what her path was going to be. And get this, she had plans to go to college and become a crime scene investigator.
Oh, that's so cool.
I know. So until her dream could become a reality, Tara got a part-time job at Charms Palace Golden Isle, basically a little kiosk, jewelry kiosk, in the Port Charlotte Town Center Mall. And being a recent graduate in a new state, working at a jewelry store in sunny FLA gave Tara this itch. So one day she walks through the front door and sporting a brand new belly button ring. And obviously Sharon was like, it's super cute. It looks great. Like supporting her. And Keith's like, eh. typical dad response. He's like, not thrilled about it, but you know what? You're 18, 19. What am I going to do?
I feel like that's such a thing to do though. When you turn 18, like get a tattoo or get a piercing.
It's true.
Like I got my industrial and my ear pierced once I turned 18 and a tattoo. So,
well, you know, at least a belly button ring would be, you could take it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tattoos, you're kind of locked in. But now that you know a little bit about Tara and her family, I'm going to get into the case. So let's go to September 30th, 2001. And it's a typical Sunday, which meant togetherness. So all five mm-hmm. family members, they had breakfast at Cracker Barrel, did some shopping at a flea market in Fort Myers, and then caught the new Keanu Reeves movie, Hardball. I actually never saw that movie.
Me neither.
No, at a local theater. And later that night, Tara had plans to go to a club in Port Charlotte with a friend of hers, who I will not name. And before you ask, the club was hosting a teen night where underage people mm-hmm. would come and party and hang out without booze being served.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So this friend picks Tara up and they do go to the club. Afterward, they stop at the home of a male friend of theirs and they hang out until the early morning hours. And then she drives Tara home. So very innocuous. And I wanted to be known that His friend did confirm that Tara did not drink any alcohol that night. She didn't do any drugs. And there was like zero funny business between her and this boy who they went to go hang out with. It was really a good, wholesome meetup, a good, wholesome night with good, wholesome people.
Aww.
So the next morning, Monday, October 1st. So Keith leaves for work super early when everybody was still asleep. But around 7:20 a.m. is when it was Sharon's turn to head to work. She checks on Tara, tells her she loves her, and reminds her that there's some men coming from a septic service company to do some work on the house. Apparently, it had rained a good bit the night before, and everybody in the neighborhood was having septic problems on that morning.
Ugh.
I know. And we're talking like backups which stank to high heaven.
I had a septic system growing up, so I get it. Oh, my goodness.
So Tara, I'm sure, mumbled something to her mom from bed, like, yeah, I'll be here when they get there. So Sharon heads out the door, and Tara likely goes back to sleep for a few hours. And the two younger kids, Veronica and Paul, they get on the bus a little after 8 a.m.
Okay.
A day proceeds totally as normal until about 3:50 that afternoon when Veronica and Paul get off the school bus. So as the children approach the house, they notice a little sago palm tree. And I'll put a pic. You would know these palm trees if I show you. They're all over Florida. They're these hardy little palms. I have one in my bathroom, a baby one. I'll show you. But they had this palm tree in their front yard, which had been knocked over and the pot was smashed. So the wind blew it over, right? No, whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
So as they're walking up to the house, Veronica realizes that she forgot her house key. So little Paul goes to open the door and realizes it's already partially open.
Oh, I don't like that.
I know. And they see Tara's car parked in the driveway. And when they actually go into the house, the TV's on and Veronica sees the bathroom light on. So the assumption is that Tara was watching some soaps on TV and then went to take, she's in there taking a shower.
Mm-hmm.
So she and her little brother go outside to play. Just before 5 o'clock then, so we move forward about an hour, a little over an hour, Keith calls the house to just check on the kids. Apparently he had made plans to meet up with a friend of his for coffee after work.
Yeah, make sure everything's okay. Do you guys need anything? That way he can go hang out with his friend without worrying.
Right, but everything was not okay. Mm. So Veronica tells Keith about Tara's car being home, but she hasn't actually seen her sister yet. Like, she goes into the bathroom then to be like, she's taking a shower, right? So she goes in there. Tara's not in there.
Mm.
And Veronica then goes into Tara's bedroom, and that's when she sees her purse, her makeup, her cigarettes, and her car keys on the dresser. So this was obviously incredibly uncommon. Because Tara would not go anywhere without those items. And right here, it's like, oh man, cue the crow.
Yeah, that's not good. Especially the car keys and like cigarettes. If you smoke cigarettes, you would not leave them behind. Like,
exactly
right. Go somewhere. Even if it was just for a couple minutes, you'd bring it. Even if you were just like going down the street.
Right. One of the other little tidbits that I didn't put in the story was that Tara's bra was hanging on the doorknob. So a lot of people said she never went anywhere without a bra. But again, they thought she was in the shower. So initially, in those very first moments. So that was another kind of one more thing that she left behind. So obviously, the second Keith hears this, a pit forms in his stomach and he immediately calls Sharon at work. But again, a big thing to remember is that Tara's 19 at this point. So legally an adult who can do whatever she wants. So Keith's thought is like, maybe there's a chance a friend swung by the house and picked her up and they'll be back soon. She just forgot to let us know.
Mm-hmm.
But then Keith sees some stuff in the house that really make him realize his concerns are totally warranted. So first off, there's a television in the master bedroom that Keith shares with Sharon. And this may sound weird, but the TV was straight on the dresser. And to most of us, no big deal. Yeah, it was a perfect, right? But Keith kept it on an angle because you could see it better from bed.
Better.
So it was tilted, but that TV was straight. And speaking of that dresser, there was a giant scuff mark on it that appeared to have come from like a boot or a shoe, maybe during some kind of struggle. Like, things just didn't seem right.
Yeah, and you know your house.
Exactly. So Keith notices his mattress, his top sheet is completely gone. And so is the top sheet in Veronica's bed on the other side of the house. So weird things like that.
That's weird. Yeah.
I know. And he found it was like blood pressure medication and a bottle of Curve cologne was missing too. And he's like, those turn up later, like under a mattress or something. Like, they're not actually gone, but they turn up in a spot that he didn't leave them. So
that's so weird.
Very weird. So at this point, Keith's spidey senses are literally in overdrive. I mean, he starts looking for other things that are out of place. And when he looks on his dresser, he notices he's missing handfuls of spare change, all these silver coins, some jewelry, like a gold bracelet, a watch, a silver Indian head ring that had like two little jade stones on the temple, and a black money clip that had a $100 bill in it. But most importantly, he was missing a gold ring with the word dad inscribed in it. And this was a gift that Tara had given to Keith, maybe for Father's Day or Christmas one year.
Wow.
And it literally meant the world to him. Like, he wore it everywhere except to work. It was probably not worth more than $100-$150, but it was priceless to Keith.
It was priceless, right?
Yes.
Like, it doesn't matter what you paid.
Correct. So Keith continues through the house and he notices some muddy prints on the carpet. Like, just not nothing, not these big foot, like visible footprints, but like just some dirt tracks.
Yeah.
So obviously Keith is beside himself at this point, and before long, Sharon makes it home and walks through the door, and he fills her in, and Sharon too goes right into panic mode because this is motherly instinct, man. She knows something is not right. The tower would not just leave with all of our stuff sitting on her dresser and without saying a word to anybody. So she immediately calls the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office. Now, we love to celebrate cops when they do good things, but we also need to call out when they don't exactly handle things properly. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's what happened here, but the responding officers definitely made the family feel like Tara was just out with friends and would be home safe and sound before nightfall, which we hear about all the time. Because I guess they don't want to jump to the conclusion that it's something bad. But at the same time, man, families know their family and they know their habits and they know their routines. And if they're telling you something's not right, then chances are something's not right.
Right. Yeah. And especially it's not like they have a record of her being a runaway or anything like that.
Exactly right. Again, we talked about that she does not run with bad crowds.
Right.
So explain that. But they did agree that the place had been robbed, and they even noticed these two giant tire tracks in the front yard leading up to where that smashed sago palm tree was. So the thought was whoever looted the house backed their truck up, because there's got tracks and then the smashed plant, to kind of load up whatever they were stealing, and they just happened to run over the plant in the process. So a burglary incident report was filled out, but detectives would not declare Tara a missing person, which absolutely infuriated Keith and Sharon.
I mean, yeah, like, your house was robbed and your daughter's missing. Like, what?
That's got to be a parent's worst nightmare, to not feel supported by the police. I get that.
Yeah.
So the police leave while Tara's parents are worried sick, and they invite some friends over kind of just for emotional support. And one of these friends, the one who remembered Tara fighting off the kids in the pool, she's there too, and she makes a troubling discovery. So she notices that two of Tara's earrings are embedded in the carpet, and one was like kind of bent as if it'd been like ripped out of her ear and stepped on, is the way it kind of seemed in the carpet. And Sharon immediately identified those earrings as the ones Tara was wearing in bed when she checked on her that morning. It gets worse, because remember those tire tracks in the front yard that I had mentioned? Well, the family is finding all of these other little clues around the house. They discover some pink and white ribbons near one of those treads. And just like the earrings, Sharon confirms that those ribbons were the ones that Tara was wearing in her hair early that morning.
Oh my God, my stomach hurts.
It's awful. It's an awful thing to think about.
Anxious. And
God, and when you know these people personally, it's just, we talked about this with Laura Cowan and how you couldn't watch the movie because it's like, we knew Laura, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So
to know these things are happening to people you know and care about is heartbreaking. So Keith and Sharon spend the rest of this gut-wrenching night waiting by the phone. And every time a car passes, they head to the window and look outside. Every time they hear a noise, they check the front door. Like, was that Tara coming through? But she never returns. And by morning, Sharon calls the police again to kind of update them on the things they found, the ribbon, the bent earrings.
Tell me they listen.
They listen this time. Okay. They agree that something is not right, and they officially report Tara missing. So obviously an intense investigation ensued, and the first thing police set out to do was establish a timeline of Tara's last known movements. So her mom, Sharon, again confirms the last time she saw Tara was around 7:20 yesterday morning when she was leaving for work. She spoke to a colleague of Tara's at the Golden Isle jewelry kiosk that she worked.
Mm-hmm.
This friend told Sharon that she actually talked to Tara on the phone about 12:15 yesterday. It turned out with cell phone records to be 12:07, but she was close. But apparently Tara had called to say that, because Tara was off work that day, but she's like, even though I'm off, I'm going to swing by the mall at some point to pick up my paycheck. But the friend says Tara never showed up. And given that Veronica and Paul got off the bus at 3:50 and Tara wasn't home, police now know that whatever happened to Tara happened between that phone call with her friend around 12:15 and 3:50 p.m. when the siblings got home from school.
At least we have a window. I mean, like, yeah. It's a short window, you know.
Which is good. The shorter the window, the more right. accurate they can be once a suspect pops up.
I don't like that we're into the next day, but I, you know.
I know. So this would not be a crime show if I did not start with some throwaway suspects.
Of course.
Their sole purpose is literally to add a little bit of mystery and eat up some TV time, which they did in this case. So I'll start by saying that Tara did not have a steady boyfriend. She would see guys from time to time, but she would never bring them by the house.
Mm-hmm.
The thought was maybe that Tara had some boy over during the day while her parents were at work and he did something to her, but that was ruled out pretty quickly. The next strange tip that crops up when police learn that a neighborhood kid had been seen with a lot of loose change. How this information was relayed to them, I have no idea, but the thought was Keith said he had all this change missing from his dresser. Now here's some right. kid who, by the way, mows lawns throughout Tara's neighborhood, was somehow now seen with a bunch of loose change.
I mean, I don't feel like that's a smoking gun there.
Was it because I said, here comes some throwaway suspects?
Well, I mean, yeah, that doesn't help, but like maybe you went to the arcade.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say exactly, but I don't want to say obviously detectives like didn't think this kid did it, but the tip appears in this police kind of breakdown of the case. So
yeah.
It was definitely something that we then as producers kind of latched onto. And
yeah.
It's a tip that police had to roll out, even if it's a weak tip, you know? So police keep their eyes peeled and eventually they find this boy. And I believe, don't quote me, but he was 17 and he had some kind of very minor run-ins with police.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually find this kid riding his bike throughout the neighborhood and they question him about the loose change. And this kid actually produces the change and it's all like pennies. Keith said he was missing silver coins. So right away they're like, I literally have no other information on this tip. Like, why this kid had all these pennies, why he was carrying them around.
Maybe he was going to make wishes in the fountain.
Exactly. You just never know.
Maybe he found a penny candy place. We just don't know.
In 2001, you can still get penny candy?
I don't freaking know, maybe, but not on candy.
So overall, it was just a very weird kind of detour, which of course means in the true crime world, we are going to milk that for everything it's worth. So
oh,
in
yeah.
the cold case files, we definitely chewed up a couple minutes with that because in this case, we really needed to hide the ball on the people that I'm going to introduce you to next. So that same day, October 2nd, police conduct a neighborhood canvas and they speak to two women, Lisa and Tina. And Lisa owns the home at 4733 Westwood Drive. So basically the home right next door to Tara's family. And Tina was a friend of Lisa's who happened to be visiting that day.
Mm-hmm.
Officers asked Tina if she saw or heard anything suspicious yesterday. And she tells them not really, because where she was sitting, everybody was outside because of all the stink.
Yeah,
so she's
yeah.
sitting in a lawn chair. She couldn't really see a whole lot because there was a fence in her line of sight to the front mm-hmm. of the house. She was kind of on the side. But she did notice a white Ford Ranger parked in Tara's driveway between 1230 and 1245. And it belonged to the septic workers. And she knows who it was because not only was their logo written on the door, but she recognized one of the men in the truck as Phil Barr. And it turns out she worked with the daughter of Phil Barr's girlfriend at a convenience store. So when he was walking from his truck to his to Tara's house, he's like, hey, Phil. Hey, Tina. You know, they exchanged pleasantries.
Yeah.
Right? So the woman Tina was hanging out with, Lisa, she was the homeowner. She confirms Tina's accounts about the truck being there because they were sitting together. So basically they saw the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So as a standard protocol, police obviously want to speak with Phil Barr at this point because it's like, man, one, did you see or hear anything? Maybe he witnessed this robbery or something that could help piece this together. And two, you want to rule out everybody, get their story on paper. And three, to hopefully narrow down the timeline of Tara's disappearance.
I don't like Phil. I just decided.
You don't like him now. You're going to hate him in a minute.
Well, the only thing I will say, if that time's correct, 15 minutes is not a lot of time.
Well, stand by, because 15 minutes is just one visit. So Sergeant Brian Harrison, who I interviewed for the Cold Case Files episode, he told me that he looked up an address for Phil Barr and kind of made his way over there in an unmarked car. And again, this was just to gather information. Sergeant Harrison arrives at Phil Barr's place on Rollins Street bright and early, talking 7:30 a.m., and when he gets there, he pulls up, parks on the side of the street, and immediately he sees a white male in the back of his truck bed, hosing it out. And then at some point, he's going over to clean the interior. Like, they kind of make eye contact, and Sergeant Harrison walks up to the driveway. So they get to talking, and Phil Barr confirms that he and his colleague were indeed at Tara's house yesterday to perform septic work.
So the guy at the house, it is Phil cleaning out his car.
It is Phil, correct.
Okay.
Yep. So he details speaking with Tara for a couple minutes, or a girl there. He didn't know her name was Tara.
Mm-hmm.
And completed his work, and then they left, like nothing out of the ordinary. But a few of Barr's actions gave Sergeant Harrison pause. And this is taken directly from the police report. So remember I said Harrison was in an unmarked cruiser when he showed up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, quote, when the male subject realized Sergeant Harrison was a police officer, his demeanor changed from one of a relaxed state to a nervous state. And Sergeant Harrison described the male as having his eyes wide open, change of color in his face, sweating, and he opened his mouth. End quote.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergeant Harrison stated that Barr was anxious to invite him into the house. And it was almost like he added a little note that was like, it was like he was trying to pry me away from that vehicle and like, come have some coffee. Come on in here. Like lure him in away from that truck.
And it's his work truck, right?
Correct. Correct. Okay. So for now, Sergeant Harrison just makes note of Barr's account on that first day. And then they continue their investigation.
I still don't like Phil. I like him even less now.
You don't have to like Phil.
Good.
Cleaning out his truck's the only thing clean about him.
Ugh.
Detectives speak with another neighbor who lives at 4711 Westwood. So we're still on the same street in roughly the same little clump of houses. They're not like around here. They're cookie cutters that you can reach out and touch the next house. They're a little neighborhood. So they're just looking for anybody, again, who saw or heard anything suspicious. So they get to this neighbor and he says, you know what? Now that you mention it, I did see a truck earlier that day. And you know why it stood out to me? Because I'd never seen that kind of vehicle before. Like it was a work truck, but it was very high-end work truck. It was a nice truck. So it just stood out to him. It caught his eye.
Okay.
And the truck, the neighbor says, was a white full-size pickup truck with tinted windows, a king cab, a diamond-plated toolbox. You know, the contractors have those boxes mounted to their beds?
Yeah.
So one of those.
Bougie.
I know, right? And it had some kind of writing on the door. So the driver's side window, the rear window.
Okay.
That was probably his logo. So the neighbor first noticed this truck in the driveway of Tara's house around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. And he didn't see anyone get out or go in the house or leave or anything like that. He didn't even see the truck leave. He just noticed it there around that time. However, what did stand out to him is that later that day, about 45 minutes later, coming from Golf Course Boulevard down the street at, quote, a high rate of speed was this same truck. And the neighbor says the truck returned to Tara's home about 3 or 4 times over the next couple hours. So he assumed it was a construction company and that like workers were using it to go take breaks, which explained the back and forth, all the, you know what I mean? All the coming and going. But once he heard that someone's missing from the house, now it's obviously jumping out to him as a little bit suspicious.
I feel like it's weird that Tina didn't tell us this. Like if she was sitting outside.
They weren't like out just outside for 6 hours. They were like inside, ran some errands, sat in, you know what I mean? They were. So the last witness I want to bring up is a maintenance company from a company called Affordable Properties. And he was doing some septic work next door over at Lisa and Tina's house at 4733. Remember the women who were, hey, Phil.
Right.
So detectives asked this guy if he saw anything unusual at Tara's house that afternoon. And he said he really didn't see anything, but he definitely heard something.
Oh.
This maintenance man said he arrived at Lisa's house around 11:50, 11:55 in the morning yesterday and had a real short conversation with Lisa about what was going on with the system and he got to work. But then around 12:15, this worker was taking a quick break, which I'm like, dude, you've been on the clock 20 minutes and you're taking a break.
Lazy so of course, ass.
I'm already calling in to question their break times. Regardless, during this break, the worker heard what he described as, quote, headbanging music coming from the house next door, Tara's house. And the music lasted around 30 minutes and was loud enough to rattle the side door of the home. Like that's what got his attention.
That's so scary. Like, cause I feel like so many times, do you remember we covered, Harvey Robinson?
Mm-hmm.
He used to turn the TV up or the radio up.
It's good for covering things up.
Exactly.
Well, and just to throw this out there. So there's a note from our cold case detectives in the file that this door, it was one of those side doors on a garage, like my house. Remember the door that I was like, we'll leave that one unlocked for you.
That I didn't know existed.
Yes. Yes.
That I thought you put in just yesterday.
Yes, that I just installed. No, that door had always been there. But that's the kind of door we're talking about. And that, so that it was a door that led to a once attached garage. It used to be a garage, but it was converted into a bedroom that Tara and Veronica shared.
Oh, okay.
Well, and all of this is learned within the first 24 hours of the investigation, so I'm sure you would agree that it was time for detectives to conduct a formal interview with Phil Barr.
I feel like, though, this is, like, too easy. Like, if you're scheduled to do work at someone's house, your name's there. Like, we know who you are. I'm confused. I'm not confused. I'm, like, confused at how stupid people are sometimes.
Well, but again, we don't know what happened yet. You right, know, so we just have Tara.
I feel like nothing good. I got a bad feeling about Phil.
I think that's fair. So who is this Phil Barr guy? I'm going to let Phil's statement, his reputation, his actions kind of speak for themselves, because I'm not going to waste my breath on this guy. And if you want to quit, you know what? If you want a quick kind of summation, Phil Barr is a drug addicted, odd jobber, criminal, mm-hmm. low-life junkie that he had at the time. He looked like Billy Ray Cyrus had a fat baby with Nick Offerman.
He sounds terrible.
Disgusting.
So a degenerate.
Complete degenerate.
Ugh.
So at 4 p.m. on October 2nd, Phil Barr gives his first formal interview. And I'm going to focus more on this one more than any other, because Phil Barr would go on to change his story, I don't know, 476 times over the course of this case, which we'll get into later. So initially, Phil is calm and cordial with detectives as he tells them about answering a call from the homeowner at 4729 Westwood regarding a septic issue. And remember, Sharon and Keith rented, so the owner of the house would have called the septic company to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So he recruits his buddy, Dave McManus. And at the time, he didn't say Dave's, it was L-M-U or L-N-U, last name unknown in the case file.
Oh, okay.
It was Dave. Called him Dave. But we'll learn later it's Dave McManus. So Phil says he knocked on the door, but no one answered. So they began kind of doing what they needed to do. And a few minutes later, he says a young, good-looking girl in a kind of a silk nighty type shirt. And it wasn't like lingerie. It was just like a soft PJ shirt, I guess.
Right.
So yeah. She answers the door and Dave McManus and this girl strike up a conversation. And they're talking about Pennsylvania, because I mentioned her car was parked in the driveway and it had the PA plates because she drove up.
Oh, yeah.
And Dave McManus is from Pennsylvania. So they strike up this conversation. While Phil Barr says he went inside and she was mentioning something about the toilets not flushing.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been related to the septic problem. So he's like, I'll take a look. So Dave McManus and this girl chatted while Phil went and looked at the commode, he called it. So as the interview progresses, Barr tells detectives that McManus told him on the ride home that the girl looked like the party type. She, quote, liked to smoke crack. And it was like, where are you getting this information from?
Yeah, where did you just come up with that?
Barr says he wasn't sure why McManus would say that, but he did. So now, Melissa, given everything I told you about Tara, is she the...
No, that's yeah. Ridiculous.
Well, that's the story that he gave to police. And Phil Barr finishes up by stating that neither he nor Dave McManus ever returned to the house. And he has no clue what happened to the girl that was there.
I feel like he's already, like, he's talking shit on our possible victim. I say possible, but victim. Like, he's already trying to put doubt in the investigators' minds that this is a serious situation. Like, oh, she's probably off doing drugs somewhere. No big deal. Like, I feel like that's such a thing that, like, perpetrators do. Like, they try to downplay things like that.
Yeah, and it downplay and also remove themselves from the situation. Like,
yeah.
anything they can do to, like, separate themselves from an incident, they're going to
mm-hmm.
do. But don't worry, he says, Dave McManus, super trustworthy guy. Like, you should talk to him. He'll tell you whatever you need to know.
Oh, right. Well, Phil, if you say he's trustworthy.
Right? So the next day, October 3rd at 9:07 a.m., that's exactly what they do. So if you'd like me to tell you a little more about Dave McManus, you can just refer back to my kind of earlier description of Phil Barr, because it applies to both. But instead of a fat baby, like, replace it with a demon from hell with an admitted eighth grade education.
Oh.
Like, seriously, wait until you see this guy's mugshot.
He reminds me of Edward Norton in American History X.
That's exactly.
Oh, I got, like, chills. Like, I just looked at him and that's the first thing I thought of. And I'm, like, picturing the scene at the beginning that I'm not even going to talk about because I'm going to get sick. But
yeah, I know what you mean.
Exactly who he looks like. His character. I forgot the name, but.
Terrifying. So McManus tells detectives that he works at a restaurant named Harpoon Harry's, but that he takes kind of any job that comes his way. And fun fact, he did quit Harpoon Harry's without notice 2 days after this very interview. So, scared much?
Not shady at all.
No. So, So McManus says he learned about the septic job from a buddy of his, Glenn Pee-wee St. John. And Pee-wee was also friends with Phil Barr, which is how he found out about the job. And I guess he couldn't do it because he had a hearing with his parole officer. Or he had a meeting with his parole officer.
Okay, I don't trust anyone with the name of Pee-wee. I'm sorry.
I know.
Between Pee-wee Herman, who freaks me out, and Pee-wee Gaskins, who's like the worst murderer ever. I don't like it.
Well, you can lump all these douchebags together. So McManus pretty much mimics Barr's statements for the most part and adds that they were parked in the driveway and mentions that Barr forgot a shovel at a Riverside job that they were doing. So he hung out there while Phil Barr drove to that other job site, retrieved the shovel, and came back. So he's already starting to lay the groundwork of why they were there so many times. Like these two have talked at this point and are getting their story straight.
Clearly.
So there's two big takeaways from this interview. One, McManus said he never left the front door area. Like that's where he talked to Tara, which was right inside the main room. Mm-hmm. And Barr disappeared with the girl. I didn't know where they were, but presumably to talk about the toilet issue. And also when asked about where he stood the entire time, McManus says, quote, "I didn't leave the front room. I was looking around a little bit, you know, checking out her house, which I do with anybody, you know." And this jumps out to police because they made a little note in the case file that was that this statement of his was consistent with the act of burglary. And like, how ironic that all this stuff was missing from Tara's house.
Mm. Okay, this is reminding me of the wet bandits in Home Alone. Remember, he goes in as a cop to like see if they're going to go on vacation and like looking around to see if it's nice.
But yeah.
He's actually the bad guy.
Dude, you don't even know the half of it, my friend. Seriously. Like, he also says, like, with his own. He's not led in any kind of way when he says that. He goes, "We never went back to the residence," quote, "nothing dramatic," or, you know, like, "well, we're going to come back here and we're going to rip this girl, rape her," you know, something like that.
Why would a rational, normal person say anything like that?
Right. And again, it's like, why are you bringing up the word rape if we don't even know where Tara is? So now all of a sudden you're throwing out all these little red flags that experienced police pick up on.
Yeah.
So before he leaves, McManus is offered a polygraph to clear his name. Nah, I don't believe in that shit. Nah. He does turn over his clothing and his boots that he was wearing that day. And long story short, they learned through witnesses that these were not the clothes McManus was wearing that day. He turned over some clothes. So that same day, police conduct another interview with Phil Barr, his second recorded statement, basically to let him talk himself into a corner now that they have McManus's case, McManus's statement on file. Now they're going to let Phil Barr talk again and kind of see how his story veers, how he differentiates. And in this interview, Barr adds a bunch of little new wrinkles to his story. Like, I think he now knows police are, remember him when that first cop shows up and he's in his truck, his face changes, like he knows he's in hot water.
Right.
And the biggest wrinkle that he adds is that someone else was in the house when they arrived. It was a young man, maybe in his 20s, and he was assumed it was Tara's boyfriend at the time, but he said he was, quote, sitting on one of the beds.
So we just remembered that he was there, or we just made up that he was there?
That's what I'm thinking. He's starting to see the writing on the wall. So I think he's starting to just make up stories, but there's a problem with this because this is the first time that either man ever mentions anyone else being in the house, but also it makes no sense because if Phil was working on the toilet, the only bedroom you could see from the bathroom was young Paul's, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he also said one of the beds. The only room in the house that had two beds was Tara and Veronica's on the other side of the house. And it's the same room that had the vibrating door that was seen by the neighbor.
Oh, from the music.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about one more thing that happened in these early stages that proves really important, because on October 4th, so we're talking about 3 days after Sharon and Keith first noticed Tara was missing, Glenn Pee-wee St. John strolls into the sheriff's office, and Pee-wee is this squirrely little degenerate. Like he's not like the others. He's like the tag along criminal that just does whatever these other guys say just to be cool. And again, feel free to reference any of the earlier keywords that I mentioned when describing these guys. And so Pee-wee walks into the sheriff's office and says, "Excuse me, Mr. Police Officer, but I have information on a girl that's missing and I'd really like to help." And Mr. Police Officer says, "Well, sure. What information do you have?" And Pee-wee hands over a handful of jewelry, including a gold bracelet and a silver Indian head ring with two little jade stones on the temple, which he says was given to him by Phil Barr a few days ago. And Phil told him he had got it, quote, from that girl's house, and asked him not to tell police where he got it.
Wow. So Pee-wee's just turned, first of all, snitch. Second of all, glad he did it, but why?
You'll see as we go along here. So one other little side note I want to mention is that on October 5th, so this was, remember I told you earlier that Dave McManus kind of quit his job without notice? Well, mm-hmm. he also fled the state. And the belief was that it was Arkansas or Maryland because he had connections there or his home state of Pennsylvania.
Mm.
So let's check in on Tara's poor family, because at this point, all of October was passing and Sharon Keith, as well as dozens of volunteers, have been scouring the woods and the wetlands and drainage ditches looking for Tara. The news crews had been following this entire thing and filmed Sharon making like desperate pleas to the media. Like they were mm-hmm. heartbreaking. Meanwhile, Sharon and Keith are doing their best to try to keep it together for the younger ones, but damn, they are going through it, you know?
Yeah.
And the guilt they carry to this day is just something that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. Can you imagine just moving to a brand new state with the hope of starting a better life and your world is shattered, like so soon after you move there and not knowing if Tara's dead or alive? Like, I can't even imagine what that.
That would be the worst part, I think, like not knowing, like.
Yeah. Well, I'm about to shatter your heart into a million pieces, so you probably didn't pick up on this, but I told you in the very beginning that Tara was born on October 30th, 1981. Mm-hmm. Well, she went missing on October 1st, which meant it was her birthday in just 4 weeks' time from when she went missing. Yeah. So Sharon and Keith had obviously bought all of her gifts, and when October 30th rolled around, Sharon was sitting there with him and is like, I'm just going to open these, I guess. And mm-hmm. her son Paul said to her, like, no, Mom, don't open them. Tara's coming home really soon. Let her open them.
Oh, that is so sad. I think that's a big thing, though, that like people will still buy Christmas and birthday gifts.
Well, yeah, because you don't want to think it's not going to happen. You don't want to yeah. put that out in the world. You know, you want to put good vibes, positive.
Right.
Coming home. So we're going to jump ahead 9 months at this point. Nothing like there's no sign of Tara. 9 months pass. And on July 12th, 2002, so Tara had been missing this entire time, and while police are certain that Phil Barr, Dave McManus, and or Pee-wee St. John have something to do with it, all they really know is they stole a bunch of stuff at this point. There's nothing directly linking them to Tara's disappearance or any foul play.
Right, and she's at least still regarding Tara. Missing. Yeah.
Ugh. So July 12th, that's what I referenced. It's a steamy Friday afternoon, about 4:30, and police get a call from a construction worker who is traveling home from Arcadia, Florida, from a job site in Cape Coral. And about halfway home, he's like, I got to take a leak. So he pulls onto Burnt Store Road, which is about 10 miles east of Punta Gorda. And he walks about 50 feet into the woods to relieve himself. And it was down a path that was described as a two-track path. That's just like a picture of kind of a little path or a road in the woods. And all you really see, there's a clearing, but there's just two tire tracks. So it's kind of a really rough, it's not paved or anything. It's just, you know what I mean? A truck goes back.
Yeah.
So when he walked back there to relieve himself, he stumbled upon a bunch of bones.
Aww.
Police immediately arrive and start combing the scene, which is an intense effort. Florida heat and humidity are not exactly a crime scene investigator's friend, because it had done a number on these bones. They were scattered all over the place, probably by animals, and yeah. they were sun bleached. And while police do end up recovering a lot of bones, it's only about half of the bones that are contained in a human body.
That's so hard.
I know. How's your heart? Put back together yet?
Yeah.
Well, good. Let me shatter it again. So amongst all these bones, detectives find a belly button ring on the ground, just like Tara's. And that's the moment that Keith recalled that he knew. And they didn't have to wait for the confirmation from dental records and all this other stuff. They just knew.
Yeah. That, oof.
So the bones are sent to a forensic anthropologist, because you obviously can't do a real autopsy at this point.
Right.
And they confirm through dental records that the victim is in fact Tara. But again, because the remains sat in the heat and the rain and the humidity for nearly 9 months, that anthropologist can only tell so much. Like, he can't determine the official cause of death or if like a sexual assault took place. But he did determine that it was intentional, because there were 4 cracked ribs. And it was almost like whoever put Tara there likely was punching her and stomping her until she could no longer fight back.
Oh my God.
So what do investigators have at this point? They now have Tara's body and they know she was killed intentionally, but they have varying witness statements from Phil Barr, Dave McManus, Pee-wee St. John, and a mountain of suspicion against them, but there's still really no hard evidence tying them to murder, which which is a huge issue, you know, and it's an issue that would plague investigators for another 8 years.
Oh my God. That's
like, isn't that nuts?
Forever.
I know. And when you have suspects so front and center, it's like just finding that smoking gun.
I know. Sometimes I wish, I'm going to get so much hate for this. Sometimes I wish like your gut instinct would count towards,
I know.
You tell the judge, be like, he totally did it. I promise.
I agree. I swear to God he did. I just know it.
Yeah. I just know it.
That's this case, but it's like, you got one shot to prove this, you know?
Oh yeah.
So before we kind of get into the case wrap up here, I want to tell you about a lesser known part of the story that really got to me. And remember I said in the beginning, like when I was assigned this story, I was going through some stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things I was going through was a divorce. Mm-hmm. And this story, I don't know. It hit hard. Obviously, with the case just lingering and lingering, it was taking a toll on Tara's family. And the colder it gets, the more stress there is, especially for Sharon and Keith.
I think that's very common. Parents of children who pass away or are sick, maybe, the marriages don't generally survive that.
Well, they fought valiantly this entire time to bring Tara's killer to justice to no avail. Mm-hmm. And while they wanted to stay close to the investigation, like in Florida, living in the area where Tara was abducted and murdered is just a cruel reminder of the life that they wanted for their family but never got.
Well, and they don't know anyone. Like, they don't have roots there to remember good things there. Like,
right.
I don't understand people who stay in homes where their loved one was murdered, but I know a lot of them are like, yeah, but there's a billion good memories and just that one bad one. Whereas like they didn't get a chance to make any. I wouldn't want to stay there either. I'd want to end. I feel like I would be so angry at like the area and like the people in the area. I know that's not rational, but that's how I would be.
I agree. And like you could have 20 Christmases that were amazing in that house. But that one event, I feel like trumps all of that. And just they did move out.
Yeah.
But they were dealing with not just this, but like a lot of other stuff. It was a serious, man, these families, the past 2 weeks have just been dealing with like tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. Mm-hmm. Not long after Tara disappeared, it was just a few months, Keith's 19-year-old daughter had been diagnosed with leukemia. And in January of 2004, then Sharon's brother committed suicide after a long battle with some pretty serious demons. And the only reason I mention that is because it is Men's Mental Health Month.
Yes.
But also that same year in August, Sharon had a quadriplegic sister named Kimberly Ann Shannon, and she was murdered along with a friend of hers by Kimberly's psychopath ex-boyfriend, Richard Jones. And Sharon took custody of her sister's daughter. But damn, like how much does one family have to take?
I don't get it. Like some people just get hit over and over.
And good people.
Yeah.
So all of this being said, Sharon and Keith had bounced back and forth between places in Florida and Pennsylvania for a while they kind of dealt with all of these different things. And eventually they moved back to Scranton, but the strain was more than their relationship could handle. And they eventually split up. However, and this is a humongous however, this amazing couple made a pact that whatever happens with Tara's case, they're going to tackle it together as if they never split up.
That's awesome.
It was a promise they kept. And like, if there was a development in Tara's case that required them to be somewhere, Sharon and Keith were there side by side. Anytime a TV show like ours comes knocking, Sharon and Keith are there side by side to this day.
That's awesome.
They're literally the epitome of what co-parenting looks like and an absolute inspiration at the time that I needed it most because it just really put things in perspective, you know? And like Sharon and Keith, if you are listening to this, you guys, mad respect because you are the people that Tara needed you to be.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the case. It's now February of 2009, and the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office decides to form a cold case unit, which bravo, because
yay, we love that.
This was headed by a great guy named Mike Gandy, who was actually an investigator with the department at the time of Tara's disappearance, and he worked some of the initial case. And Gandy recruited two other recently retired detectives, former U.S. Naval criminal investigator Mike Vogel and former Stafford County, New Jersey detective Kurt Mail. And the idea was that these experienced investigators who have zero ties to the case will be able to look at it with a pair of fresh eyes. And these guys are awesome. This team, it was like Kurt Mail and the Mikes. I mean, it was the three of them are a pack. And this was the first case that they tackled. So this team gets to work and they sift through like 40,000 documents, like original reports.
Wow. And
these boxes are a disaster because so many people had like picked at it through the years and like people don't put stuff back where they found it. So these boxes are just kind of, with all the rummaging, they were all over the place. And that's why the document that I was looking at exists, this 900-page document, because Kurt Mayle is one of the most organized dudes I've ever met in my life. He took all that information and compiled it into a legible kind of chronological timeline of the case with new notes. So I wish I had it printed out. I could show you. It would be like, it was like you're reading an old report, like here are the facts of the case, but then there would be like new information in red, and where he would just be like, reminder to the reader, X, Y, and Z never happened, even though they just said it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it took them about 6 to 7 months to kind of go through everything, and they were hoping to find something that their predecessors had missed. And obviously the focus was Phil Barr and Dave McManus, because in all the interviews that were conducted over the years, their story differed almost every time, specifically about the number of times they were at Tara's house, their alibis for that day, and what Tara was wearing when they spoke to her. Like, all these little details were changing every time.
And they threw in the imaginary boyfriend.
They did. Yep. The amount of imaginary things in this case, and that's those red notes. It was like, here's what the witness said on this date. And then in red, it was like, this is clearly untrue. It was proven later, this and that.
Right.
They were also lying about kind of where they parked Phil's truck the day of that they were working on the septic system. So none of it lined up. It was like clear they were all lying and lying poorly. But what can really be done about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The cold case team knows they need to find some kind of unclosed loop. And that's when Kurt Mayle finds one. It's a tiny little nugget that would eventually bust this case wide open. So do you remember the neighbors that were sitting outside their house, Lisa and Tina? And Tina waved to Phil Barr?
Mm-hmm.
So while Kurt Mayle noticed that during that interview, Lisa mentioned that her sister-in-law Ellen had stopped by that day. But he's looking through the box, all these boxes, and cannot find a single interview with Ellen. It was like, so it was a possible witness that hadn't given a statement. Hmm. So she was never interviewed. So that was like, okay, let's interview Ellen. Maybe innocuous, maybe not, but we'll see what she has to say.
Yeah.
So Kurt Mayle and Mike Gandy meet up with Ellen, who is obviously shocked to see them after all these years, but her memories of the day are still quite vivid. And it turns out that where she was sitting in the front yard, there was no fence in the way. She was further out where that fence wasn't blocking her line of sight. So she had a much better vantage point of Tara's house than Lisa and Tina did. So that's why she saw way more than they recalled.
Right.
And one thing that helped, and this is super cool, this strategy that Kurt Mayle employed, because the landscape of those houses had changed so much. Like, if you go on Google Maps and take a picture to show them, there's sheds there, there's trees there that weren't there in 2001.
Right. So, a fence might be gone. Yes, yeah.
Exactly. So Kurt, what he does is he prints out aerial maps of the area and photoshops out anything that's new. And he wants to try to make it look. Yeah. Like, try to make it look exactly like it looked in 2001.
That's such a good idea. Like, not to get off subject, but with Sarah Yarborough's case, I wanted to show a map of the school, but it's so different from what it was. That's such a good idea.
Well, the goal of this is to give her like an exact image that she can, like, her memory can go back and recall that time period. And she would actually like map out. She put a little number one, like she made a key. She'll draw on the map with a Sharpie, like number one, white truck parked. Number two, this is where I saw, like, where she was sitting. So it's just wild. It's so simple, but yet so smart.
Yeah.
So Ellen recalls for detectives getting a call from her sister-in-law, Lisa, saying her septic system had backed up and asking if Ellen would kind of come over, keep her company. She had to run her kids' places, like just come help out with this situation.
Yeah.
And so Ellen did. She dropped off her kids at school in the morning and then made it to Westwood Drive by 9:45 a.m., pulled up a chair on the front porch, and she was just kind of sitting there. But as the day went on, the stench from the house got stronger and stronger. Oh. So she started moving her chair further and further and further out. Now she has this great view, and at 10:30 in the morning, she sees this white pickup truck pull into the driveway. And Ellen recalls seeing two white males exit the vehicle. They were joking around and looked to be in a very jovial mood as they went around the back of the house. And a short time later, her sister-in-law, that's when, remember, Tina was like, oh, I recognize Phil, right? Mm-hmm. So that happened, and they exchanged a little conversation like, hey, am I on your list of septic problems to fix? And Phil's like, I don't know, not yet. So they had a little conversation. But Ellen said then she left to run some errands and returned 45 minutes later. When she got back, the truck was gone. But a short time later, she saw it again, quote, whipping down the street.
Which is like what the other neighbor said, that they were speeding away. Yeah,
exactly. So it slammed on the brakes right in front of Tara's house. And this is the moment here. So it slammed on the brakes right in front of Tara's house, reversed into the driveway, backed up onto the lawn right in front of Tara's front door. And the same two men got out this time, but they were quite serious. Their demeanors had changed completely. They went directly inside. And when she saw him come out a short time later, both of these guys were covered in sweat and Phil Barr was shirtless.
Ugh, put it back on, Phil. Ooh.
Seriously. Well, obviously, detectives are floored by Ellen's account. Like, for the first time, they have a witness that saw Barr and McManus entering and leaving the house, returning several times, parking all over the damn place, and acting all sweaty and shirtless and feverish. She was literally the missing link.
Holy crap. And no one talked to her. Oh, my God.
I know. So let's wrap this case up. So arrest warrants were issued, and the search for the suspects was on. So investigators do locate Dave McManus in Cumberland, Maryland, where he's apprehended without incident. He's interviewed, more lies, whatever.
They believe I'm involved, yes, they do, based on statements that you have made,
that I've made,
yes, and you were incident, according to you, and statements that you've
given. I've never claimed I was there more than once.
Yeah, yeah. So you see, you can't keep the story straight there.
Phil Barr, though, still MIA. And it turns out, so he's eventually found living in a trailer park in Vermont under an assumed name. And he had cut off the glorious flowing mullet, and he's just kind of clean cut now. Yeah, I mean, he got with the times. And so police believe he was up in Vermont so that he could be close to the Canadian border, like, should things go south. And so he'd been waiting all these years just for, like, the cops to come. So he's trying to kind of hide out. And U.S. Marshals show up to the house, this trailer, and Barr immediately bolts out the back door where other U.S. Marshals are waiting for him. And he's
idiot. Like, you think they're just not going to check the back door? Like,
I know. I'll go out the front.
I'm sure it's fine. Like, good one.
So I know we're running long, but there's two more little nuggets that are super interesting that I really want to share with you guys. Because if you hated this merry band of shitbags before, I have one more shitbag to introduce you to. Linda Dilley. And Linda Dilley was Phil Barr's girlfriend for something like 11 years. And so she'd been with him throughout the course of the investigation.
Oh, ladies, do better.
Well, it's 2012. And so basically 11 years, give or take, after Tara's murder. And police and prosecutors are busy building a case against Barr and McManus. And as they're doing this, they come across an audio recording of a jail call that was made between Phil and Linda way back in 2002. So about a year and a half after this all went down. Phil was in jail. He was being investigated for some other drug charges. So although this call had to do with Tara's case, it wasn't discovered as part of Tara's case. That's why it didn't initially kind of cross detectives' radar.
Yeah.
I think there was a detective working that drug case who passed away. So I think some things just got lost in the shuffle. Regardless, this recording, Melissa, I'm going to play this for you and try not to reach across the table and choke her through the monitor.
I know more than what I'm saying, and I totally expect to eventually be arrested for some and I'm so sick of that girl missing. I hope the girl's laying someplace dead in the middle of the woods, rotting away with ants eating her eyes out.
That statement, like, I can quote it to every word. It's infuriating, and it will live with, like, in my true crime career. That's a statement that I will never forget. Like, how awful.
Yeah, she's fucking foul. I wish someone would eat her eyes out.
But the worst part is that that's what was happening. So she knew exactly what was going on, and they're keeping their conversation candid. But Phil had written a letter, apparently, and stuck it in a book on the bookshelf. Like, I think he knew he was getting arrested, so he wrote down some things. I don't know what that letter says, to be completely honest. Like, I'm sure it's in the file somewhere, but I didn't have access to it. But in this letter, he mentioned some things that I think she knew, right?
Yeah.
So that's the letter they were talking about when they're having this conversation. So this tape obviously has everybody fired up. Like, Sharon was absolutely livid. Like, how dare they talk about her, Tara, that way? And the cops were just pissed off now and more motivated than ever to put these monsters away.
Good.
Linda had been interviewed before, so cold case investigators began digging into those statements. And back in 2001, both Linda and Phil Barr claimed they were on the phone together. So we're going to get into their alibi a little bit. Claimed they were on the phone together kind of throughout the day. They were scheduled to have lunch. He, like, left some steaks out or something in the thawing in the sink or in the fridge. And they even made plans to go to Golden Corral for dinner that night. So there was no way he could have committed this murder.
Oh, and clearly.
So to note, police back in 2001 did subpoena all the cell phone records, but no records were ever returned for Phil Barr. And the cold case team digs into this little tidbit and they learn it was because Phil's phone wasn't even active because he wasn't paying his bill.
That tracks.
It does, right?
That's...
The phone company didn't turn it on until October 16th, so which was like 16 days after Tara went missing. So, yeah, she's lying. And so Linda's charged with 2 counts of perjury for lying to police, and lo and behold, her lawyer is ready to cop a plea deal in exchange for immunity.
Oh, man. Guess there's no true love there. What a bitch.
Well, detectives aren't ready to like bend just yet on this deal, so they kind of devise a plan. They want to get her to talk and hopefully just divulge everything she knows about the case and hopefully hit her with more charges, you know?
Yeah.
So they decide to have Linda interviewed, but not by the cold case detectives, but by FBI agents. And these 2 FBI agents, they thought should be female to kind of make her feel more comfortable about maybe opening up to somebody she hasn't yet already.
Yeah.
One of these FBI agents they decided would be like a kind of a motherly type, you know, to try to get on Linda's good side, while the other one was going to be more regimented, talk more law enforcement procedure. So to kind of like literally good cop, bad cop, you know?
Yeah.
So on October 23rd and 24th, they interview Linda Dilley in 2014. And from the get-go, Linda had consistently defended Phil Barr, saying she knows he's not the most savory character, but she didn't think he had anything to do with Tara's disappearance or death.
Except for your phone call, but okay.
I pulled a gun on Philip and I told him, if I ever find out you had anything to do with this Philip disappearance, I would have ordered you extremely nice and shove it down your throat. And we never told him anything.
So the FBI agents can obviously tell Linda knows more than what she's saying. So the good cop steps in and reminds her about her grandkids and that she could be guilty by association and to like go away for a long time if she doesn't come clean. And also just like the get that weight off your shoulder and also maybe do something good in your life and help get justice for Tara.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons to do that, Linda. You got grandkids. You got to be looking at jail time. You can unburden yourself, and you can help Tara get justice. You just have to tell us everything that you know.
Well, that's when Linda decides to reveal a little more, but again, not enough to like incriminate her, just enough to be, to drop some information, but I don't know. So she slips up when she's telling this story, though, and says she remembers seeing a body in the driveway wrapped in a beige sheet the day Tara went missing.
You mean like a top sheet from a bed?
Sure do. So, and the second she said that, she goes into damage control because like, oh, I just said I saw Phil Barr with a body and I didn't tell police before today. She goes on to say they shot a hog or they hit a hog with the car or something and they needed to like move it. So I didn't know it was a body. I just knew, I thought it was a pig.
Oh yeah. Good save.
I think they had killed a hog and I think they were trying. They were wanting to put it in my trunk, and I wouldn't let them. Is what I. But basically, yeah, it would have been a body because it was a hog's body.
I love that she's coming up with yet another story. We never heard about the pig, like.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like the imaginary boyfriend, the imaginary pig.
That's what I mean. Like every single interview has something different, some crazy little detail about some other person I talked to or what they said or what, the, you know, so, but she also goes on to say that she remembers that night, Phil Barr coming home and doing a load of laundry, which he never, ever did. And he also had asked her at one point how to remove blood and get stains out, et cetera. And none of this was mentioned to investigators in any of her statements up until this point, or any of Phil's or Dave's or Pee Wee's, anybody's statement.
Well, of course not. They're not going to mention that. But yeah, that would seem weird. Phil doesn't seem like the type to be doing laundry or anything of use.
Yeah, right. So Linda cuts a deal with a state attorney and agrees to testify against both men, Barr and McManus. They are tried separately. Phil Barr's trial begins on October 24th, 2015, which is just a few days short of the 14th anniversary of Tara's murder. Mm-hmm. And that's when detectives' theories about the case start coming to light. So they believe that this was supposed to be a robbery from the get-go, that these two were just career criminals who had sticky fingers and would just steal things from job sites and sell them later on for drug money.
Okay.
Well, on October 1st, 2001, Barr and McManus responded to Tara's home to deal with a septic problem, all on the up and up. And once they knock, though, they see this pretty young girl answer the door. She lets him in, and Dave McManus keeps Tara preoccupied in another room while They're talking about the Pennsylvania mountains and how much they miss it and all this stuff. While Phil Barr grabs what he can find, pockets it, and proceeds to like fix the toilet or pretend to fix the toilet, whatever he was doing.
Yeah.
And the thought is Tara caught him stealing stuff. Because McManus was on probation, I did not mention that. So he obviously didn't want to be linked to a robbery at this point. So whatever happens to Tara next is anybody's guess, but investigators believe a struggle ensued, which was evident from the earrings in the carpet, the scuff marks on the dresser, the stuff out of place. Like, now they're in a complete panic, these two idiots. So especially because Phil Barr is waving to neighbors beforehand, like, oh, hey, Tina. Hey,
yeah,
Phil.
And everyone can ID him. Yeah.
God. So they leave and return several times. And each trip, they're more frantic. And that's their efforts to clean up the crime scene and get Tara's body out of there. And that's when the neighbor's eyewitnesses account come into play, because they got this truck coming and going, speeding down the street, backing up into the driveway, into the yard, crushing the sago palm tree. And Tara was literally taken out in bed sheets that were missing from the master bedroom and Veronica's bed. She was taken to this wooded area off Burnt Store Road and just left to rot in the hot Florida sun.
That's so scary. Like, it reminds me of BTK, how like, remember he was like, yes, would go into people's houses like to fix things, but then like really just to get not like get the layout of the house. And like, I feel like the thought of you're trusting someone to come in your home, like the Comcast guy or the Pico guy or whatever, and this happens. Now, I want to know, did the company ever get in trouble for anything? Like the septic system company?
What was his company? He owned the company.
Oh, he, okay. Okay. I wasn't sure if it was like, okay, got it.
Yeah.
And how did they, why did they pick that spot on Burnt Store Road?
Yeah. It's funny you should ask, because remember our good buddy Pee Wee St. John, who turned over the stolen jewelry? Well, Mr. I want to do everything I can to do to possibly help this investigation had been lying the entire time as well. Like, he lied about his alibi. He lied about how he obtained the stolen jewelry. He lied about what he was supposed to do with the jewelry. He lied about his relationship to the two guys. He also failed three polygraphs over the course of this.
Pee-wee.
Oh, God. So when Pee-wee was interviewed back in 2003, so this was a couple years after Tara's disappearance, he told police that on the evening of October 1st, 2001, he was having dinner at home with his girlfriend and his young son when Phil Barr showed up, handed him this jewelry. And somehow later, Pee-wee ends up in Phil Barr's truck with Phil and Dave McManus, and they were heading to the Jones Loop gas station. And during this drive, McManus started talking about a body, like unprompted, no backstory, no lead up. So, okay, Pee-wee, I'm sure that's exactly how
Yeah, sure. That's exactly what happened. Yeah. Sure,
Pee-wee. Well, apparently McManus wanted Pee-wee to, he wanted Pee-wee's help to move this body further back into the woods. Pee-wee says, no way. And then a confrontation ensued between he and McManus. And according to Pee-wee, McManus told him he knew too much and, quote, could just join the fucking bitch, end quote.
Oh, my God. I'm going to punch him in his fucking face.
Right. So Pee-wee's obviously terrified of film. So he claims of Dave McManus at this point. So he says he accompanied the men to Burnt Store Road and they turned off down the two-track road about 50 to 100 feet in the woods. Pee-wee says he saw a body, claims he just took a, quote, quick glance.
Oh, yeah. And just a quick glance.
Yeah. And he noticed this girl had light brown or blonde hair. She had one arm up over her head and the other hand down by her side. And he was just horrified and refused to help. And the point of me telling you this is that police learned that the area was an area known to Pee-wee St. John. He had done work there in the past. So the thought is that he's the one who suggested the spot to hide Tara's body. And because he too was on probation, the other suspects in the case tried everything to like keep his name off detectives' radar. So Pee-wee was never charged in this case, but there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that he played a role in it.
Oh, yeah.
And worse than that, he admitted he saw a body, which he knew damn well was Tara's by that point, because news was all over the place. On October 1st, he knew she was missing, meaning his actions caused Tara's friends and family to suffer and grieve and worry about where she was for 9 months. That is the most inhumane thing you can do.
Yeah, but it's not surprising. Like, these men are obviously, like, such white trash. Like, when they die, no one's going to be upset about it. They're going to leave a skid mark on society. That's it.
Seriously. Well, this will make you feel better, because I did read an article just the other day, actually, when I was kind of researching this case in the Herald Tribune, that Pee-wee was charged with sexual battery of a child under 12 in 2015. So,
Jesus Christ.
Mr. Helpful just continues his charmed life. I can only assume that when he's released, he'll get a respectable job and probably volunteer at orphanages on weekends and
Help the elderly, walk them across the street.
Yeah, he's just such a gift to society. So, Phil Barr's trial, the jury deliberates for 90 minutes before finding him guilty of first-degree murder. And 2 years later, Dave McManus is found guilty of the same, and both men are sentenced to life in prison. The old LWOP.
Oh, I love LWOPs.
Exactly where they belong.
Life without parole.
So that is the tragic case of Tara Sidorovich, and it is one that I will never, ever forget, mainly because of the impact Tara's story had on me and the amazing connections I made with Sharon and the cold case team, you know? But there's one more little haunting tidbit that I want to share with you. And this is, you want to talk about behind the scenes? This is literally, you will not hear this anyway. Like, no one else could have experienced this. And it was one of the creepiest things that's ever happened on a shoot in my entire career. Late April 2022, we had wrapped up the filming of the Cold Case Files episode roughly 2 to 3 weeks earlier. And I get a text, and here's a printout of the picture that was attached to this message. I'm going to show you this, but I'll post it on screen too. My cameraman got this letter at his house. And Melissa, this letter, the handwriting on the envelope is purposely childlike. My guess is to disguise the author. And the return address is J. Lopez with no P.O. box and written like a toddler, like held a pencil with his foot and wrote it. Inside this letter, Melissa, is a fucking map listing the cameraman's home address. And there are cutout magazine letters on it, like serial killer shit, that reads, insert cameraman's name, I know where you home and auto, and another word, another cutout word that says family. Like, look at this thing.
Oh my God. Who the fuck does that? Like, who actually sits there and cuts letters out of a magazine? How much time do you have? Oh my God.
At the bottom, if you scroll down, I blacked it out.
Yeah.
There's a cameraman's home address, and there's Punta Gorda where we were filming. Because you can see Punta Gorda in this map, my hunch is that someone tied to the case, and I have my theories, got wind that we were filming, and they knew kind of what we were filming.
Yeah.
And they did a little homework on us, and they tried scaring our cameraman because they didn't like him sniffing around the case.
Oh my, of all the people to threaten, it's the cameraman. Like, way to go, asshole. Like, of all the people, like,
just between us girls, like,
idiot.
The initial thought was this cameraman cheating on his wife or girlfriend? And like, was this like not even related to what we just did? But it was too strange because he's like, no, he's got a bunch of kids. He's got a very happy family. And he's like, we literally went to a couple of restaurants while we were out. We didn't really talk to anybody. So this is just bizarre. And it's That's behavior so weird. Like, spend your time doing something else. Maybe reflect on all the bad shit you did throughout the years instead of threatening people who are just trying to report on it. So that's Tara's case. And damn, like, re-researching it, I was in tears. I was fired up. It's just this story. I don't know. I will never forget it.
It was such a stupid reason for her to lose her life. And they're just so, like, there's not a better adjective than you're just fucking stupid.
All this because you wanted a couple rings and a handful of change.
Did Keith get back the dad ring?
I don't know for sure. Keith definitely like identified the jewelry as his when it was returned. Yeah. So, I mean, I would need to ask him. I forget if that ring, I don't believe.
Oh, I hope so.
So that is the case. And I'm really excited to let you guys hear from Kurt next week. He did a hell of a job on this one. He and the mics.
Well, that's really exciting too, that we're going to get to talk to him. And thank you for sharing it. I know it was a little bit emotional, but you did it. So that's good.
Especially after Lilo and Stitch, man. I was coming into I'm driving home going, there's no way I'm going to be able to record this tonight after seeing that.
You know, that's on the list of tearjerker movies I heard. It's like Steel Magnolias, Titanic, Lilo and Stitch, Lilo. Schindler's List. You know, totally understand.
Well, it touched me, Melissa, in ways that I can't even express.
Okay, well, you and your little blue alien can go touch each other. Moving on. Well, tell us what you guys think about the case. You can hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky, which I think is hilarious because I don't really know what I'm doing. But yeah, I'm just going to admit it. But anyway, we're on all of those.
Are you just posting stuff on Blue Sky, like random stuff?
Yeah, and I'm not really sure if it's on our profile or like there's different channels and I don't really get them. So I just kind of...
Hey, no one contact us there.
No. Anyway, we're on there at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com Or you can send us a message through our website at www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Yes, you can.
Also, I'd like to point out that I think perverts wear mullets. I think we need to note that because the pervert in my case 2 weeks ago had a mullet, and then your pervert had a mullet.
There's a lot of mullets going around.
Well, until next week, be nice. Cut your mullet. Nobody wants to see that.
True.
And remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they do not.
They have bad haircuts.
Most of them do.
Or they look like that lady. Rough.
No comment. See ya. Oof.